Welcome to this dietetic discussion with me, Dr. Anne Holdaway, a podcast in which I have the privilege of talking with some of the leading lights in the field of nutrition and dietetics to bring to you thought-provoking, factual, insightful information on a range of topics to enhance your everyday practice. After a short break that followed the first episode of season three, in which I discussed gut health and diversity with Dr. Megan Rossi, I'm delighted to welcome today one of our previous guests, Professor Philip Atherton. We first spoke with Phil in episode three of our inaugural series to unpick the topic of protein quality. And whilst we covered a lot of ground, we felt there were still many stones left unturned with regards to understanding the constituent components of protein and how this might influence both protein quality and protein utilization. With an increasing number of individuals in the general population embracing the need for higher protein diets, and also turning towards plant-based eating and concurrent market growth in clinical nutrition products containing protein derived from plants, we thought there was no better time to revisit this important topic on protein quality. And I'm delighted that Phil has kindly agreed to join me once again so that we can delve deeper into the intricacies of different types of protein and any potential advantages or disadvantages in relation to absorption, utilization, physiological function, and clinical outcomes. Before we begin this week's discussion, I just want to express my considerable appreciation to the team at Nutrinovo for supporting what is now the third series of the dietetic discussion. Without Nutrinovo's support, this podcast simply wouldn't be possible. As a company, Nutrinovo have consistently demonstrated an innovative approach to clinical nutrition, and having worked in the medical nutrition industry myself, I'm very aware that innovations often emerge from clinicians working in partnership with industry. It's therefore not only great to have Nutrinovo providing support to make these podcasts possible, but I also hope that a discussion held on this very podcast series might be the springboard for generating product innovations, such as Nutrinovo's latest oral protein supplement, ProSource 20. Well, without further ado, I'd love to get started. And first things first, I'd like to introduce Professor Phil Atherton. Phil is a professor of clinical, metabolic and molecular physiology at the University of Nottingham. Following a postdoc, he was awarded a Personal Research Council's UK fellowship and studied responsive muscle to nutrition and exercise as a function of age. He's been principal investigator and co-investigator on numerous high-quality studies and secured grants in excess of 10 million from various esteemed sources, including UK research councils, charities, industry, and other funding sources within the European Union. He's published more than 150 non-abstract peer-reviewed articles and also written 7 invited book chapters. Phil's productivity in his career to date is inspiring, and I consider it a huge privilege to have Phil here with me today to unpack what we understand about protein sources and types, protein quality, and how this influences protein utilization. So welcome, Phil.
Hello, Anne. Always nice to see you all, and happy to talk about this topic today.
Great. So I'm wondering first, Phil, if you'd like to provide some insights for our audience as to what sparked your interest in this specific area of nutrition, namely protein utilization, muscle mass and function.
Yeah, sure. So I come from a bit of a random background in that my PhD initially was kind of in sports science area, not even in nutrition, actually. And my background was actually in preclinical research and cellular signaling. So understanding how external cues, but that includes nutrition, obviously, or physical activity, or drugs or whatever might influence, you know, how the cell reacts and stuff like that and regulates metabolism. So I was fortunate enough that I got a postdoc at the University of Nottingham. And then there was in the offering some Research Council UK fellowships at the time, one of which was focused in molecular nutrition. And so I was fortunate enough to get that fellowship and thereafter study how the human body responds to protein nutrition. The reason for protein is simple. It's that it's the main macronutrient that influences protein metabolism in all tissues and none less so than skeletal muscle. So I studied a lot of the fundamental basis by which skeletal muscle responds to nutrition and exercise and the combination of the two, also in conditions of just health, but also aging and multiple different diseases more laterally. And I guess the link between what I said from the outset about understanding cell signaling was one of the really interesting things about protein is that it contains amino acids which directly tell the cells to build or break down proteins. So that was really my interest.
Thanks for that. And it's not surprising then, given all that you've done, that we've invited you to speak on this topic today. But I know last time we spoke, you talked about sort of protein metabolism and utilization. So I thought, to start off with, could you explain the difference between whole proteins and hydrolyzed proteins for our audience and any potential benefits when it comes to muscle protein synthesis, absorption, and tolerance?
Sure. So going back to my fundamental protein biochemistry, so whatever protein you eat or whatever protein is in the body, they have different structures. So they're essentially, we call it essentially a primary amino acid sequence, right? So it's peptide bonding amino acids, long chains of them. And what they do in the body and as we eat them is they form more complex structures. These are, I guess, going back to fundamentals, form primary, secondary, tertiary, and even quaternary structures. So little things like, so you get a single amino acid chain, and what will happen is it will form things like disulfide bonds between cysteine residues. So that gives it a sort of secondary structure. And then they may, for example, fold further, and then they may also combine with other proteins as well to create these really complex structures. You've got basically in its most form, you've got globular forms of protein, where, for example, within the cell, the hydrophobic areas are covered up such that they're soluble. And then you've got things like fibrous proteins or collagenous proteins, which I know we'll go on to. So you've got these sort of cellular globular structures, and you've also got these sort of fibrous matrix proteins, such as collagens, which we'll talk about. And essentially, what happens with hydrolysis is that you've got those complex structures that you can break down. So you can do that. I mean, obviously, during, for example, processes of digestion, you do that anyway. So things like even in the mouth, as it moves into the stomach, into the small intestine, you've got enzymes which enzymatically target the peptide bonds to break them down into smaller structures and less complicated structures. And what happens is you can do that, of course, ex vivo. So you can take food and process it in that same fashion ex vivo. So you can apply either acid-based or enzymatic hydrolysis. And all you're doing essentially is chopping the things up. So you chop them into much smaller sequences. And the theory is behind that is essentially you can make them more rapidly bioavailable. And by bioavailable, what I mean by that is available in the bloodstream such that they can go and perform the usual trophic effects that the tissue targets tissues such as muscle.
Okay. And if you look online and look in the stores, and for women who might be here today on listening to this podcast, we often hear more and more about collagen as being a key ingredient in many protein supplements. And it's also following on that we're seeing it sort of emerging as a good quality protein for clinical nutrition products. What do you see as a benefit of collagen over other protein sources?
So it's difficult to say over other protein sources, but in addition to is probably, I guess, more applicable. But collagen is mostly made up of non-essential amino acids. What that means is that theoretically the body can provide its own, it has de novo, what we call pathways of de novo synthesis to generate those non-essentials. Whereas the essentials, of course, have to be taken in through the diet. That's the distinction between the two. What's actually really crucial potentially is that the non-essential amino acids make up the composite of things like the extracellular matrix protein. So the extracellular matrix is in every tissue, right? Including, again, I'll go back to skeletal muscle because obviously that's going to be a major focus of this podcast. So within, you've got the intracellular bits of muscle, and then you've got the extracellular, and it's all anchored together through the extracellular matrix. So it's really important. And actually, essential amino acids do not stimulate the production of matrix proteins, such as collagen, which is important because it means that if, for example, you take in non-essential amino acid sources, it will facilitate the production of extracellular matrix within tissues like muscle. But at the same time, of course, the major collagenous depots of the body, which are bone, skin, ligament, and tendon, And so the fundamental basis is to use, I think, those properties to facilitate the remodeling of those extra, as it were, musculoskeletal tissues that are more collagenous in nature.
Mm. And do you think that from describing where the collagenous materials are in the body, in the human body, should collagen be a preferred choice of protein? Or, like you corrected me earlier, is it about collagen being in addition to other protein sources?
Sorry, I wasn't really correct. Just a minor point. I think in terms of, like I said, the essential amino acids contained within more, you know, as you were, as it would be defined as so-called high-quality protein, and we'll get to that later, I think, contain obviously mostly the predominance of essential amino acids. Those essential amino acids do not stimulate collagen synthesis. We our lab and others have shown that many, many times. So I think the idea is that the addition of non-essential amino acids is going to provide that function.
Mm. And do we know if there's a natural difference in the absorption rate of hydrolyzed collagen compared with, say, whey protein and other plant protein?
Some depends on how the preparation is generated of collagen. I think we might also get to that. But with the processing that's typically, and also I would actually add the distinction that as well, that it's not just about necessarily collagen versus other protein sources, but it's actually that if you have a hydrolyzed form of a protein, I guess the main gist of that is that it's going to get across into the bloodstream quicker, more quickly and more completely, most likely. And actually, whether that is collagen protein or and collagen is readily absorbed as well in certain forms, or whether it is whey protein or whatever, they do the same drill, right? So they hydrolyze the protein outside of the body. And that, if there are instances, for example, that whereby there may be a rate limiting reason why protein is not absorbed most efficiently, then hydrolyzation, of course, makes perfect sense.
Mm.
It's worth stating at this point that the way that protein is absorbed is not as protein, and it's not even necessarily as free amino acids, unless you provide it as free amino acids. It's actually as very short peptides, typically di- and tripeptides are the main way in which they get across the enterocytes into the bloodstream, eventually past the portal system.
Yeah, and I think there was quite a landmark paper going back to the 1980s, actually, which looked at the absorption of amino acids and, as you say, di- and tripeptides, which was really a flagship paper in clinical nutrition that talked about. And tripeptides, for example, were more rapidly absorbed than the amino acids in terms of the when you supply a total quantity
Absolutely. It doesn't mean free amino acids are not absorbed if you give them free. No. But what it means is that we don't process to produce free amino acids. Typically, we actually have enzymes called di- and tripeptide peptidases within the blood that will do that job, such that when they arrive at the target tissues, they will then be able to enter the amino acid specific amino acid transporters as free amino acids.
Mm. And we've touched on hydrolyzed protein and collagen products for starters. Is the actual source of the protein relevant? What we see in the marketplace amongst clinical products is protein that's derived from bovine, marine, plant sources. So is there a difference in terms of the quality of that protein?
Yeah, okay. Quality is difficult to assess because I don't think there's a marker for quality of, and I'll get to that a little bit later, I suppose, because if you go to some of the scoring systems for quality, then proteins, which are some of these proteins you describe, are going to be very deficient in certain amino acids, which would limit the scoring quality.
Mm.
However, this is a field definitely in its infancy, and collagen proteins can be described from all of those things you describe with different processes and nuances to them. One thing I will say is that we know certain things about distinctions in the quantity of certain amino acids within them, even non-essentials. So collagen derived from fish sources have generally been shown to contain lower proline and hydroxyproline, which is the sort of, you know, cross-linked form of proline, than collagen derived from pig or bovine sources. But warm water fish, for example, tend to contain the highest proline and hydroxyproline context amongst the different species. So there are differences between them, right, in terms of individual amino acids, which may become relevant if you, for whatever reason, think that there might be a high proline or lysine requirement. I'm just giving a random example. Also, the process of extraction does vary depending upon the collagen source. So, for example, if you're taking it from bone, which has a high mineral content, versus skin, which has a high fat content, some of the processing is actually quite different that's required. So I think we don't know really yet, but I think that there may be rationales whereby certain ones that have favor certain non-essential amino acids may be more required in certain circumstances.
And you can see there's a lot more to unpick on this subject, really. And obviously, within the market, we've now got plant-based proteins, sources of protein, really to meet the needs of individuals who are asking for plant-based products. So can you get vegan collagen?
Well, oftentimes, actually, what happens in those instances is that the plant-based sources are very zero to limited. So what happens is that you often provide in what would be seen as facilitative nutrition in the production of collagen. So a couple examples would be I wouldn't even call them precursors, but things that like silica or vitamin C, which may impact the activity of enzymes involved in, let me give an example. So vitamin C, it might be involved in, say, cross-linking. So like, for example, prolyl hydroxylase, the enzyme which cross-links proline, may have a co-requirement for vitamin C in that process. And I think that the major focus, as I understand it, of those products is to facilitate the processes involving endogenous collagen synthesis rather than directly providing the building blocks and substrates.
So we talked a little bit about absorption of di and tripeptides, and I'd probably like to explore that a little bit more about the digestibility and tolerance of different types of protein. So does the type of protein and its source affect the osmolarity of protein supplements? And does this have any effect on absorption or tolerance?
I think this is, to my fairly limited knowledge of that area. I know it's in infant nutrition, osmolarity is a big deal, and looking at those sort of aspects, I think there is a potential to affect gastric emptying, obviously. I mean, work we've done, for example, has shown that the rate of amino acidemia in healthy conditions are not really so critical, but it doesn't mean that in others it isn't critical. So again, I'd say that there isn't good hardcore evidence one way or another about that, but it certainly is a consideration. I think that things like tolerance is a difficult word because it's like taste and volume are also critical factors, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Way more than I do about such things. But like sometimes one example I would say is obvious is that there is often an attempt to pack in protein into smaller volumes where volume may be an issue. A good example as well is on a research level a product development level, free amino acids can often taste pretty disgusting. So that has to be a consideration as to how that goes into the food matrix. I know that obviously the industry has developed really good ways of masking those nasty flavors that we often give to our research participants.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Tolerance is, how do you define tolerance? Because we look at tolerance in terms of gastrointestinal tolerance. So as you say, does it empty out the stomach effectively, particularly in somebody with nausea? You wouldn't want to adversely affect that. And then is it absorbed well? And what then happens further down the line in terms of its utilization? Coming on to sort of doses of protein, and I know we touched on this in the last podcast, but we're hearing on the ground of the use of large boluses of protein, both in the clinical setting, but also I was aware from yourself that there's a study looking at the merit of significantly large boluses of protein. So what do we understand at the moment about maximum dose of protein beyond which there is no benefit? And would you expect all of this protein to be utilized by the body, or is it utilized as an energy source if you give too much? And does it also have the potential to create unnecessary stresses, particularly in those who are unwell?
So going back to, there are two ways of looking at, there's not two ways, there's lots of ways, but, you know, there's two camps, I guess, across biosciences in terms of understanding things like protein requirements. You've got people that focus on muscle, right, because it's a big organ system. It's the biggest organ system in a healthy individual, and it's the biggest store of, obviously, amino acids in the form of protein. And you've got the whole body, people looking at whole body utilization, right, without going into technical detail. And I would say that I don't know the exact numbers, but I would say that muscle utilizes, you know, or lean tissue utilizes roughly, well, I don't know, up to half or something like that of the dietary protein that you take in. So clearly it's a really important organ system, obviously. And as I said, it stores the amino acids in the form of protein, right? And that's our muscle mass. There are some technical reasons why some of the whole body stuff, which I get really boring if I started talking about, there are some technical and mathematical reasons why some would suggest from the whole body nitrogen balance stuff that there is no upper limit. Where to start with? There was also, so the study recently, Anne, that you just suggested there was basically given 100 grams, which is a huge whack, obviously, of protein. And what we've shown in terms of muscle over the years is that if you feed I think the biggest we did was about 50 grams back about, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago now. And we were interested in looking at how the muscle responded in the building response to that protein. So normally what happens is you're taking protein, gets to the muscle, the amino acids get to the muscle tissue, they switch on anabolism or growth of muscle. In other words, accretion of protein. So you just basically, you make those amino acids into new proteins. And that lasts for about a couple hours. So you build and then it stops again. And even if there's loads more amino acids floating around, they don't really have any effect. The study that gave 100 grams recently, I suspect what happened was that the amino acids actually hang around quite a while. And the body has to deal with that. And they have to eventually excrete them in the form of urea, which is the ultimate end product of protein metabolism. So I suspect what happened was there was still load. The muscle switched on, switched off. And then 3 hours later, it just switched on and switched off again because there were still loads of amino acids lying around. Now, whether that's beneficial or not, overall, I don't know. Whether it has deleterious consequences, whether it's any different than giving 20 grams and then 3 hours, 4 hours later, giving 20 grams, I very much doubt it. Does it put added stress on the body, potentially, if you do that routinely, especially with renal insufficiency, obviously? And like you said, Anne, in certain circumstances, yeah, sure, they can feed byproducts in muscle, for example. The branched chain amino acids can be catabolized into feeding into the TCA cycle for production of ATP, but it's a pretty small contribution. But I still think if you look at the dose response stuff in terms of muscle, pretty much 20, 30 grams, maybe as you get older in certain conditions, it's going to slightly change. What have I missed?
No, I think, and in terms of that dose response, you also have to think with oral nutrition, and people depend on diets, how feasible it is for this target of 20, 30 grams to be met, and 100 grams just seems so unphysiological in a way. So I'm amazed that they actually chose to study that amount.
Yeah, I think it's a case of just doing something rather radical. And I honestly think as well, this was not in a clinical population, but I honestly think that all you're studying is essentially the muscle will become refractory to that anabolism. It does. We've done that and others have done that many times. And if those amino acids, what will happen is they really do stay high for a long time. 100 grams, you will have elevated amino acidemia for, I don't know, I can't remember from the paper, but honestly, 8 to 10 hours probably. So is it a shock that it goes up, it goes down again, it flattens, then it comes back off on and off again? Probably not. So it might seem controversial, but I don't think it has a great deal of clinical application in any case.
Yeah. And we've touched upon absorption in terms of absorption of amino acids and dipeptides and tripeptides. Are there any other factors that might influence the tolerance of a protein supplement and the absorption, for example, the additional vitamins?
I mean, I've obviously previously mentioned about, like you said, about osmolarity and gastric emptying, which may be a factor. I mean, I'm personally, I don't know, again, and this is something you'll know far better than I do, but I'm certainly not aware of anything in terms of addition of micronutrients or electrolytes having any negative effects systemically on metabolism as we measure it, if that makes sense. I think these things are specially formulated to facilitate, I think, like the role of dietary protein, for example, and not inhibit it or affect it negatively in any way. So, I mean, I'm not aware of it.
No, and I'm not either.
I think the point is, if you have, like, again, I'll give an example here, because if you take vitamin D, then there's good evidence that depletion of vitamin D may somehow impact, you know, negatively impact muscle metabolism, which may also therefore create conditions which don't allow, for example, dietary protein to operate most effectively. But
yeah,
I think it's kind of those facilitative nutrients that sort of try and create all of the correct conditions to make sure that everything can do its job right.
I totally agree, Phil. And in fact, when you look at sort of clinical nutrition in particular and protein supplementation, you still have to address requirements for all other essential nutrients. And vitamin D is an interesting one because we know it's linked to sort of the fast twitch muscles. And in elderly people trying to get out of a chair or move around, that's important. And there are many people in the UK will be vitamin D depleted throughout the winter months. So, yeah, I think in clinical nutrition, it's important we address all nutrient requirements. Moving on, at various time points across my career, I'm aware there's been interest in research on specific amino acids in clinical nutrition, and some examples being the use of supplementary arginine and glutamine in enteral feeds, which has sort of moved in and out of favour according to the outcomes. Is there any new evidence emerging to support targeted supplementation using specific amino acids, either in healthy individuals or specific settings that you're aware of?
Well, I mean, this is obviously, Anne, as you'll know through your, this is a minefield as I'm aware of it. And there's so much data out there. I'm not sure how much actually gets clinically translated to good effect. I think it's worth pointing out the fact that the conditionally essentially amino acids is always an area of much attention, because there may well be circumstances where these things will be, you know, further supplementation will be required. Sometimes it's difficult to reconcile because, for example, if you take glutamine is at 20 millimolar in skeletal muscle. It's the most abundant amino acid. Yeah. It plays an important pH buffer. And so I find it difficult to speak on that topic because I think there are just so many claims. And I do think that if people are going to go down that route, then making sure to screen for deficiencies in the systemic circulation of these things would be, and then to look at, of course, what might need to be supplied in addition. Immunonutrition, Anna, which again you'll be only too aware of, has been around for a long time now, and that includes amino acids such as the ones that you've cited there, glutamine and arginine, as precursors to things that will support immune cell function, because that's what they're major consumers of those amino acids.
Yeah.
For example, as it pertains to muscle, leucine is the obvious one to call out.
Yeah.
It's been suggested that there is a sort of leucine trigger, right, for protein synthesis, probably not just in muscle, but in all tissues. So ensuring sufficient leucine and efficacy of leucine is probably the, sorry, from my perspective anyway, the biggest thing in preclinical and clinical nutrition.
Yeah, I'd agree. And limiting amino acids is another term that we refer to. What does it mean and what implications has it for muscle protein synthesis?
So limiting amino acids essentially goes back to protein quality at its heart. The idea is pretty simple. It's that I'll turn it on its head and say, if no single amino acid is rate limiting for protein synthesis in the body in a postprandial state, then everything has happened as it should have done. And all of the things that have changed between the post-absorptive and postprandial periods have been reversed, right? And what I say by that is, sorry, when I say that, I mean that, of course, you're in a constant state of the body as a whole is in one of two states always, post-absorptive and postprandial, right? So one, the idea is to absorb and to utilize those nutrients either for storage or for metabolism. And then once that's reversed, the opposite happens, right? You liberate. So you've got constant flux between these two states. A rate-limiting amino acid means the opposite. It means that essentially you have either one or multiple amino acids that are insufficient in the intake to maximize the anabolism that occurs in a storage that occurs in a postprandial fashion.
When we then come back to protein quality, And I think there's been a little bit more published through products in clinical nutrition and through companies talking about how they measure protein quality. How do we measure it? What is there an ideal method? Is it even possible to have an ideal method? I've heard of PDCAS, which is protein digestibility corrected amino acid score. And there's also the DIAS, which is digestible indispensable amino acid score. And in fact, earlier I read a paper in Nutrients that was 31 pages on protein quality. So it's obviously a difficult topic.
So PDCAS and DIAS are essentially ways to, as you say, and to take a single protein source and to ascribe a does it or doesn't it have, and to what extent does it have rate limiting amino acids? Okay. The DIAS is a way that essentially samples are given protein source at the terminal at the ileum where the amino acids are absorbed, whereas the PDCAS takes account of fecal excretion, again, without going into huge amounts of detail. And obviously, this is going to predominantly be a dietetics audience who will understand that to a degree anyway. But there's so many other ways too. You have, and there's new ways, I mean, indicator amino acid oxidation, whereby you can simply keep giving people, give people a test protein amino acid and see when they start to exhale fat, the 13 carbon, suggesting that they're not incorporating that anymore. And that is essentially otherwise going to oxidation. That gives you a sort of break point of the requirements of that amino acid. And there are lots of ways to do it. And I'll give some other examples about some of the pitfalls here. So, for example, grain protein has a PDCAS of around, so one would be a perfect score, right?
Yeah.
Of about 0.4, 0.5, and it's limited by lysine. But on the other hand, it contains more than enough methionine, right? So, if, for example, just to give an example again, that it can be a single amino acid. You then have methods like, for example, nitrogen balance studies. Again, and these are the oldest of the old, right? So these are studies where you actually look at when does somebody go into a positive balance. If you're unfed, you're negative, you're losing nitrogen from protein. You feed, you gain nitrogen. It's when you go into that positive balance is the requirement essentially. And it's also worth mentioning that you can also tweak things in a way that is outside or outwith of these criterion. So for example, let's say you take non-essential amino acids, right? But you supplement them with key essential amino acids. Then that falls completely outside of all of the realm of quality, right? So there's lots of nuances here, and it's a complex area and it's still in huge disagreement in across the fields with people in different camps of all these different methodologies and such like. I don't think that helps a lot, but
well, I certainly see in clinical nutrition there's a lot of debate around this. And it was interesting you say how for like plant-based products in clinical nutrition, we can manipulate the PDCAS score of that by adding in specific amino acids and making it what we understand to be providing more essential amino acids from what we know about our population. And there is still debate in cancer, for example, about high quality protein. Should it be coming from animal sources because of the amino acid profile in that? Or again, if you are having a plant-based diet with lots of variety, and I think this is the thing when it comes to our diet, we're often talking about a lot of variety, but then when we move on to clinical nutrition, we might be selecting a product where you haven't got all that diet variety. So I think it's then crucial that those products work towards having a good quality as protein of protein in them as we understand is possible at the moment. And I think on that basis, is then PDCAS probably something that dietitians should be looking out for or looking at when they're looking at products, if that information is available? You said the ideal is a PDCAS of one. Is that something that dietitians could maybe look for?
When I look at the tables, which are the sort of recommendations of quantities that are required of each amino acid, it's over 3 years of age, right? Or sorry, before or over 3 years of age, how well that reflects requirements in all these other instances and in aging and such like, and how that links to protein requirements, I don't know. I mean, I'm a metabolic scientist really at heart, so I don't know. But I think it's something that needs a lot of thought. And I think that things like I said, when they talk about the individual amino acids, at least something like the indicator of amino acid oxidation, which again, I'm not trying to use complicated terminology. It literally is a case of trying to find out when you start to produce stuff that is saying it's not incorporated, gas, breath gas, that's saying it's not incorporated into protein, it's going towards oxidation, and you have this break point of how much you've pumped into the body, it might give a better idea of requirements in certain states, including aging and clinical conditions.
Which brings me on nicely to protein requirements and what we understand about that. And certainly since 2014, 2016, we've seen ESPEN produce the clinical guidelines which promote a higher protein intake as we age, sort of over the age of 55. They're now promoting 1 gram of protein per kilogram body weight in the aging population. We're seeing in different clinical conditions the mention of 1.2 to 1.5 grams per kilogram body weight. So what are your thoughts from the work you've done and all of your knowledge in this subject about protein requirements across the ages?
Yeah, good question. So I think one is that obviously there is some evidence base there, I think, on different levels of whether it be longitudinal studies, metabolic studies and such like. I'll give a few points, I guess, here. So I think that, for example, when it goes to muscle, a good collaborator and colleague of mine, Stu Phillips at McMaster, did a nice study where they collated a bunch of data looking at the muscle building response to different levels of dietary protein across age. So it was kind of a study where they look back on cohorts that they'd done in the past and tried to understand, to achieve a certain level of building muscle protein, what requirements differed maybe between young and older. And it looked like, from my memory of it, was around about now a 30% higher quantities to achieve the same building properties. Mm-hmm. So to me, that strongly suggested that higher requirements are indeed there and they could potentially preserve muscle with age. Then I'll flip to a longitudinal study, which, again, there aren't many out there. It is self-reporting stuff, so it has to be taken with a wee little pinch of salt, but hasn't everything. Essentially, it was a 3-year longitudinal study, and they mapped the protein intake to muscle mass maintenance over 3 years. Again, pretty difficult thing to do because mass loss over 3 years, even in 70 plus, is not always very high. Mm. They showed that those in the highest quintile of protein intake were the ones that best maintain their lean tissue. So I think the ESPEN stuff that's been generated sounds good, but obviously this is essentially people getting together in a room and just making some fairly arbitrary decisions, not necessarily based on huge amounts of solid data. Mm. But overall, I think the weight of knowledge that we have would suggest that that is indeed the case. And I will just finalize by saying that not just us, but we've shown many others have reported differential handling of amino acids or dietary protein with aging. So for example, loads of stuff relating to inefficient utilization or incorporation into body proteins. Things like increased splenic extraction. So how much does the microbiome, enterocytes, liver grab before it even gets into the bloodstream? What about delivery to the tissues? What about when the amino acids flood into the cell? Is the cellular communication in the right state to be able to maximize building of those proteins? And I give just one practical example that we always see. If we feed younger and older adults protein, doesn't matter what the protein is, we always see the same thing, is that if you look at the curve of the appearance in the blood, it actually perversely looks higher in the older folks. And you think, well, that's great because it means they're absorbing more or whatever. No, it doesn't mean that. It means they're clearing it less. And so we always see that. So there's definitely an issue with that handling. And I think that all directions point towards there being an issue such that higher protein, certainly at the level of the muscle, is going to be more beneficial unless there's a reason not to.
And I think certainly what I'm seeing in clinical practice with an aging population, and from all we know to date, and like you say, the ESPEN guidelines are often consensus and of variable quality of research supporting them, but sometimes it is about what's determining best practice for here and now in clinical nutrition. But there are many factors that will influence sort of protein utilization as we age: insulin resistance, hormone changes, drops in both men and women of testosterone, reduced activity that arises because of aging joints, and then reduced absorption from the gastrointestinal tract. So We've talked about this protein dosing and quality. Would you say they're of equal importance, or is one more important than the other?
Well, again, going back to things like quality, it's such a complicated question and thing to topic to deal with. They're both important, obviously, ultimately. But you need to have sufficiency. And ultimately, wholesomeness and sufficiency are crucial. And we also have to consider the anabolic resistance factor. Sorry, that's what we call the relative deficit in ability to build for an equivalent amount of protein in an older individual than a younger individual. Really, given what I've said previously, I'm not sure it's worth me trying to dissect that any further, but clearly both quality and quantity are, and wholesomeness, or whatever that means.
In terms of synthesis of protein, that's where activity and resistance training also could play a part.
Well, my final point on that matter was exactly, so things like, there are the obvious things like quality, quantity, but there are also things like, as you say, distribution, right? So, I mean, again, no expert in this, but I'm well aware for most nations that small amounts are taken for breakfast, for example, and even lunch, and then bigger amounts for dinner, potentially. So there are distribution matters that may come into play. If physical activity, and as you say, it's overlooked, but we've shown so many times that what physical activity does is potentiates the anabolic response to nutrition. There's no question. That's exactly, it's the same if you take an athlete or a young person training, you're in negative deficit. If you're in negative balance, protein, negative nitrogen balance, if you just exercise, nutrition is utterly required to reverse that. But actually, what's really important as well is that in aging, the best way to maximize the effect of nutrition is to have layer on some kind of physical activity. It's absolutely clear. Mm-hmm. So if you really want to maximize nutrition, you have to have some kind of contractile activity too.
Yeah, totally. And I think sometimes in clinical practice, we think we're having to send people down to the gym for hours on end. But there are certainly studies coming through in elderly populations where you look at good quality protein, however it's defined, and actually a certain dose around the 20 grams combined with some resistance activity. And that can be as simple as sit to stands, exercises throughout the day, just trying to keep as active as possible can really make a difference to functional outcomes. And there was a good study by Ron Dinelli on that. So I think it'd be great to see more of these studies that you were talking about, Phil, about this sort of longitudinal studies going forward, where we actually study certain populations in certain clinical settings or in the community to look at the impact of protein quality, quantity, and also resistance training, how we can make a difference to how we age. Now, last but not least, I just want to ask you about your views on sustainability, because not a day goes by where we're not reminded about the whole sustainability agenda. And we hear a lot about sort of cutting down on our meat intake because of the impact on the planet through methane production, for example. So have you any views on how we might think about the planet whilst also thinking about choosing products, for example, that have high bioavailability that might come from the bovine source?
Again, well, complicated issue and certainly not fully in my wheelhouse by any means, but I have a few thoughts about that. I think that some things are like, so something that's worth pointing out, I suppose, that you typically have, as I understand it, the carbon footprint from, I mean, I know this is, it's a very complex issue, has the sort of the beef industry stands above all, and then it moves down into the sort of dairy world and then poultry a little bit, and then it goes into obviously the other sources around the sort of plants, pulses, and even, and as you might say, insect type proteins and stuff, these novel forms of deriving proteins. For example, some stuff is produced by as a waste product as part of a given industry, which actually is I guess an efficient way of doing things. So an example of that is collagen from as a waste byproduct from beef production. Whey protein sits in the middle somewhere as it's a very high quality protein source, contains about 8% leucine. So obviously an important protein source. Then you've got the more novel plant proteins. And as you move down to sort of plant-based sources, of course, the concern is you start to hit those rate limiting amino acids. And I think that the trade-off has to be such that we as a there is some more of a limited meat production, but there is also a recognition that in certain states, sufficiency of all of the required requisite amino acids has to be met. So I that's all I really can say. I don't have the solution to that, but I think that whether that's through fortification or such like approaches and understanding of those rate limiting amino acids, I think that's the way that the sort of fields will move forward. And then of course you've got the lab based protein development as well, which is on the sort of stocks at the moment to try and generate lab based, in particular lab based meat products, which have a lower carbon footprint.
And like you say, it's a quite a complex area. We often just think about the animal and the land on which it's managed and where it's transported to, but it is all about in terms of plants. You have to water them and fertilize the soil, and there's gas production from animals as well as energy required to extract the proteins. So
and the same goes for marine stuff, and as well, I think as a great example, it just depends how it's fished for. Is it sustainable in that? Is that species going to still be around? What about extinction? What about fishing? So there's so many different aspects. And my guess my final point on this would be things like going back to biology and about things like muscle versus whole body and DIAS and PDCAS in particular. You often find actually that a lot of this so-called emerging protein stuff performs pretty well at the level of the muscle, at least if you believe the literature. We haven't done any ourselves, but there's been quite a lot saying this compares equally to this. And it may well be that actually the scoring systems like PDCAS and DIAS, which as robust as they are in what they try to do, do not really report exactly what happens at the level of the muscle. So I think we need to bear that in mind as well.
So finishing on that sort of ethical note, but bringing it back to the science as well, I'd like to thank you, Phil, for really taking the time today and sharing your expertise and all of your knowledge in the subject area, equally highlighting some of the gaps about what we don't know as well, but taking your time to sort of unpack what we understand about protein sources and types, protein quality, and how it might influence protein utilization. So thank you so much, Phil, for joining me, and maybe see you again sometime.
Thanks, Anne.
In today's episode, we've explored numerous factors that influence the tolerance, acceptability, digestibility, and absorption of protein. We've covered what we currently understand about protein quality and quantity, and how the source and type of protein might influence utilization and physiological response in muscle and other body tissues such as skeletal structures. We've touched upon the effects of aging on utilization and requirements, and why resistance activity is crucial to maximize the effect of protein on muscle accretion. We've even dipped our toes into sustainability. I hope you've enjoyed today's discussion and that it has enhanced your knowledge on what we currently understand about protein quality and quantity that you can take away and apply in everyday practice. Once again, I'd like to express my considerable gratitude to Phil. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do subscribe to the Dietetic Discussion, and we'd also be grateful if you could leave a 5-star review and promote it to your colleagues or department. Before we leave you, I'd like to just mention a final word about our partner, Nutrinovo. I'm delighted that Nutrinovo have agreed to continue to support this podcast into its third series. Their innovative approach to clinical nutrition makes them a great fit, and you never know, a discussion held on this very podcast series may even sow the seed for another innovative product like ProSource or High Fiber. For all the latest sneak peeks and updates on the next episode of the podcast, follow at Nutrinovo across both X and Instagram, or alternatively, check out the podcast section in Nutrinovo's Resource Center on Nutrinovo.com. Finally, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to listen to the Dietetic Discussion. Do let us know if you'd like any topics covered in the future. With more hot topics to come, we look forward to you tuning into the next episode with some of the leading experts in nutrition. Finally, thank you to you for taking the time to listen to the Dietetic Discussion. The next episode is going to be another truly insightful one, so be sure to tune in for that. Thank you for listening.